You're listening to a podcast from 702.
This hour, we will be looking at the state of ANC politics as well as the state of the state. Those matter enormously to our economic as well as our socio-political health. If the ANC sneezes, the entire country catches a cold. And I think on the show the last couple of weeks, you and I, despite being political animals, haven't done a very good job of keeping tabs on some of the minutiae of the factional and the other fault lines and battles inside the African National Congress, even though we are often state-centric when we talk about some of the broader social and political issues. So it's going to be a dynamic conversation with two excellent guests. I'll introduce them in a second. But broadly speaking, the first half an hour, I want to ask, does President Cyril Ramaphosa have a grip on the issues inside the ANC? And then in the second hour, I will have more of an emphasis on what the implications are, however the first part plays out, for some of the detailed questions around the state of the state and very particular issues from xenophobia to the state of the economy, femicide, racism, and everything else in between. Joining me for this conversation is firstly Professor Richard Calland, who's a professor of public law at the University of Cape Town, although he is catching the last part of summer in Berlin, where I was a couple of weeks ago in an absolutely stunning time, but he's made some time for you and me despite traveling. Richard, good morning to you, and thank you so much for agreeing to come on.
Well, that's a great pleasure, Eusebius. Thank you for having me on again, and greetings from Berlin.
Are you on holiday or pretending to work or doing both?
Is there a difference? It's a bit of both.
That's fantastic.
Ever
in studio with me is ENCA, a broadcaster who's the host of The Fix, as well as a political commentator. And that synonym for old veteran journalist, Karima Brown, who joins me in studio as well. Karima, it's been a while since I've had you on the show. Always love your insights. Thank you so much for coming into studio as well.
Thank you for having me. And hi, Richard.
Hi, Karima.
Okay, Karima, I'm going to start with you. Top line question. Is Cyril Ramaphosa in charge of what's going on inside the ANC in particular?
Well, I think he's trying to be. The ANC is a contested terrain, and it's important to realize that there are several political projects underway in the African National Congress. People often forget that it is a very layered organization, very textured, with different sets of interests, different generations, hidden hierarchies. And I think the president's agenda is not as in control as it should be. I think he's continually trying to broaden the space for that, and that is why you have a situation where the president would, for example, apologize around issues of xenophobia, and you have someone like Esma Khashule saying there is no such thing as xenophobia, it's just a criminality. So it is a contested area, and the president's project is one that is gaining ground slowly but not fast enough.
So is he in control?
I think
we're giving full marks for effort. A for effort.
I think he is in control insofar as he is able to link the power of being the president of the governing party, because we have a party political system, and being president of the African National Congress. His signature for me that differentiates himself from other ANC presidents is that he's recognized the importance of the South African public, that whilst he's the ANC's president, he's the president of the entire country. And that is why he's probably the only president in the history of democratic South Africa that apologized to another country's people for the way in which they were treated when they booed him at the funeral of the former head of state of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe.
Okay, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. There's an interesting distinction to be drawn, Richard, isn't there, between being the president of the country and being the president of the African National Congress. When you are the president of South Africa, you have both duties and powers that come with office that inhere in the constitutional edifice as the most important source of your authority and what you can and can't do. But when it comes to Luthuli House, when it comes to fighting factional internecine battles inside the ANC, then we are back to the branch as the most important unit, and ordinary, very poor, often members of the ANC that can, because of structural conditions of the economy, be susceptible to the whims and the skullduggery of some of the other members of the NEC. Can we start off by evaluating the president vis-a-vis his leadership inside the ANC? We'll come to the state more explicitly later.
Thank you, Sarah. There's an awful lot in that. Several questions you packed into one. Let me just try and deal with a couple of points, if I may. Mm. The first is, it's clear that Ramaphosa, like any president since 94, has two hats to wear. The one is the president of country, government, head of government, and the other is the head of the ANC, obviously. Mm. It's what I call the second job, is his Monday job, because he tends to spend Monday morning at the Tuli House. Unfortunately, he doesn't probably have enough time on that Monday morning to take care of ANC business, because the ANC is such a complex, as Karima says, such a complex creature, and fraught with so many problems. Arguably, it's an organization that is broken beyond repair. Some people whose opinions I respect feel that. They believe that it's beyond redemption, that any attempt to rebuild it, to reunite and so on, is doomed to fail. And then, in a sense, what Ramaphosa needs to do is in a sense, sidestep the ANC and just focus on leading the country. And even if that means that he only serves one term of 5 years rather than 10 years, I think the argument is, and I'm sorry, I'm leaping ahead somewhat in your plan for the next 45 minutes. But linking the two, and they are linked, as you suggest, Eusebius, they really are. You can't separate out these two roles that he plays. They're connected. And they really are connected for the constitutional reason that you allude to, which is that he is not directly elected. We have to remember that. Mm. Although we all of us talk about him, Ramaphosa, winning a new mandate in May, it's not actually strictly legally constitutionally true. His party won a new mandate.
Yeah.
They got it almost certainly, the polling evidence suggests they got it because of him, because people were willing to give a Ramaphosa-led ANC a second chance after the disastrous last decade. But the truth is, it's the ANC that owns the position in government, and he, therefore, is there because the ANC put him there,
yeah.
And he has to take care of his party. He can't ignore his party, much though we might want him to do. So we can't forget that. But the intersection point I wanted to make very, very quickly is that I think there is an argument for saying, look, we would be better off having five, or it's only 3 years left until the next ANC election, and he may lose that. But it would be better for the country to have three strong years of leadership now than 10 or seven kind of weak years where he muddles along trying to manage the ANC and lead the country. And I think perhaps that's the heart of this debate, or part of the heart of the debate.
That is such an interesting strategic point that Richard is making. I'm going to make a mental note because I want you to engage Richard on that. It's a wonderful, creative, forward-looking way of whispering into the president's ear and say, have a legacy, even if it's 3 or 4 years long, and the annals of political state history might remember you favorably, regardless of what happens to your party and the country thereafter. But I want to put the pause on that for 1 second, because I want you to explain something, Karima, that we don't explain enough in the public, and myself included, and you understand this better than I do. The Zuma project has morphed. What is its current character? Who are some of the actors trying to sabotage that Ramaphosa project inside the ANC, and how deep are those tentacles inside the structures and the geography of the ANC?
I think Jeremy Cronin from the South African Communist Party puts it best. He talks about a fifth column inside the African National Congress that is consistently undermining the reform project, both inside the party as well as the state. Now, what a lot of people don't realize, when you speak about, for example, the branches, we know the kind of gatekeeping that happens. So, for example, in a place like the Northwest, almost half of the branches were declared, not branches in good standing. So the very basic unit of the organization is a place of contestation. Mm. And, of course, people refer to a member's member. You are part of a faction rather than part of an organization. So it's important to understand that the African National Congress is deeply, deeply contested. And that a part of the African National Congress often cooperates with other opposition parties and social groups, be it the Black First, Land First organization, be it the EFF in some instances, and in others, be it the Katrada Foundation, be it the Helen Suzman Foundation, and even sections of civil society like Freedom Under Law, etc., etc. Because, as I said, they are contesting political projects. So my understanding of the morphing of the, let's say, for lack of a better word, political elite who wants to use the state as a way to access private lodges, is that it cuts across political parties. We've seen people in the Democratic Alliance being involved. Musi Maimane, for example, has to explain to us why he declared a house that he doesn't own, and he still doesn't want to tell us what rent he pays or show us the slips of the monthly debit orders that goes off. We know the EFF's relationship with VBS Bank, and of course also the ANC's relationship with the EFF in looting that bank in the Limpopo province. Many of the people that left for COPE, for example, had business relations with people who remained in the African National Congress, particularly in the Gauteng province. The whole issue around the Gauteng project, the Gautrain project, for example, and a range of projects that were involved, you know, links people to each other in monetary and financial terms. The EFF's obsession, for example, with Pravin Gordhan, apart from the fact that it's racist and that it amounts to, in my view, fascism, has to do with the fact that it could have been anybody, but it's a person that represents a political project that is directly opposed to theirs. So, for example, the links that President Jacob Zuma formed with criminal elements, which is never properly explained. Like, for example, why you would find a lion cub in Athlone, the link between organized crime, corrupt officials in the state and political parties, and the use of rogue security elements. You had a very fascinating discussion on Rika, for example. But I was thinking as I was listening to that conversation, we haven't spoken about private actors who have access to things called grabbers, which are enormously powerful machines that can listen to conversations of hundreds of thousands of people that has been used in the factional battles in the African National Congress. We also have the rise of the provincial barons, the kingmakers. The historical leagues have been decimated in the ANC. The Youth League, for example, still is fighting to have a conference. The Women's League, you know, their teeth has really been pulled on so many issues. But you have powerful provincial elites in the African National Congress that have pushed. And of course, the best representative of that is the three people in the top six that are former premiers and strongmen in provinces. David Mabuza from Mpumalanga, Ace Magashule from the Free State, and then, of course, Paul Mashatile from the Gauteng region.
What that specificity that you have outlined in detail tells me is that without being a party pooper, two things that made many South Africans initially optimistic that the worst is over was the election to the highest office of President Cyril Ramaphosa, and number two, commissions of inquiry that give us a sense of mechanisms of accountability are in full swing. But what you've just summarized in the last 2-3 minutes suggests to me that one should not be naive while holding out hope that renewed leadership inside the NPA, elite crime busting units, will do their work without fear or favor, that the careful observer, the investor, the active citizen should not think that the thugs have gone away, and that in some regards, even though everyone knows the country has got various crises like the economic indices, in some ways things are still as edgy as they were during the worst of the Zuma years.
In fact, it's a battle in close quarters. It's combat in close quarters. So, for example, you have the heads of crime intelligence, the head of the Hawks, the head of the NPA, the head of SARS, all changed. But the infrastructure that their predecessors left is, of course, still intact. So you have fight-back campaigns, for example. You have, look at the SABC, for example. You have now a massive inquiry into whether or not there was a deliberate attempt to make the president come across as someone who can't, you know, do a pre-recorded interview. And, of course, there is the use of intelligence structures by different ANC leaders. I mean, the front page of the Business Day tells it all. It says, Ramaphosa questions Mkhwebane's motives. This is a Chapter 9 institution that's supposed to be a break on power being questioned by the president because she went beyond her remit of looking at the CR17 campaign funding. And of course, the president, whilst he was the deputy president of the country and the ANC's, emails were hacked when it emerged that he had an affair for which he had to then issue an apology in the run-up to Nasrec. So the machinations are continuing. What is interesting, though, is if you look at the public protector as an institution that is supposed to be above the fray. Most of the EFF complaints are being prioritized by the public protector over cases that have already been investigated for months. The Estina Dairy Farm case is a case in point. So what you have is a very textured state infrastructure that has people in key positions or in strategic positions that are still able to undermine any effort to clean up the state. And it's not as if the Ramaphosa political project is without its own problems and without its own weaknesses. And of course, then what you also have is a group of younger people that believe that the fight between, let's say, the Zuma people and the Ramaphosa people is an old fight, that this is a battle about completely new blood. But if you don't look at the money, then you won't see the connection between what is supposed to be an intergenerational push from younger people. But they are financially connected to both sets of projects that has historically characterized the ANC for the last decade.
Absolutely. Richard, this raises for me many questions. I'll just pose one to you, and you can also say whatever else comes up for you as you listen to Karima's articulation of the lay of what's beneath the land, as it were. And the question it raises for me is, beyond the negotiator orientation that is his default mode of trying to problem solve deep problems, do you think President Cyril Ramaphosa, both in relation to his Monday job and the one in the state, have got enough variety of tools in his toolkit to be able to navigate the complex set of problems that Karima has just summarized in the last couple of minutes?
Probably not, because it's probably not humanly possible to be able to do so for one individual. And indeed, one of the several lessons I think we've all had to learn and engage with since December 2017, when Ramaphosa won at Nasrec, is firstly that one person is not in itself going to be enough, however good a leader they are, is not going to solve all of these complex myriad problems that the country faces. Secondly, that the rot around and very, very deep, as Karima says, and that the 10-year, it's a cliche now, but it took 10 years to degrade the state, to undermine our democracy, and so on. And it's going to take, unfortunately, at least that long, I suspect, to rebuild it, because the effect of the Zuma years was not just one man. This is the third lesson. It wasn't just Zuma in the end, as typically happens with this kind of corrupt project. It gets into the blood. It gets into the organs of the ecosystem of the state and society and the economy. And it creates its own momentum, and it has its own kind of lifeblood thereafter. So you cut off the head. Zuma goes. He may even end up in prison. Who knows? But the body lives on, and you've got to, as Karima puts it so well, you've got to, through hand-to-hand combat, take out every single remaining cell of that network that has been created. So those are the three lessons we've learned since then. What then, to return to your question, Eusebius, is this particular leader up to the task? It's a question, of course, many people are asking. They're worried about whether or not he has the right tools, the right the skills, the right aptitude. And what I said in my Mail and Guardian column, I think it was 3 weeks ago or so, was that he needed to be more muscular. He needed to be tougher. Now, what do we mean by that? You know, it's a bit of a shallow statement on one level. But when you're up against the sort of forces that Karima described, these intersecting political and economic and organized crime kind of networks of interest, then you really do need to be tough. Now, he can't do it all his own, but he has to set the right tone and he has to take more risks. And I think the prevailing view of people who do know him well is that he isn't often a risk taker, that he likes to line up all his ducks, and he likes to be cautious and make sure everything is squared up before he moves. He is capable of ruthless action. We've seen that in the past. You could argue that his whole campaign in 2017 was a demonstration of ruthlessness, that all that the CR leaks, 17 leaks show is not any criminality or breaking of any rules, because there were no rules to break, in my view. What it shows is a guy who was absolutely tough and determined and focused on one single job, which was winning. And what I think, and what I argued in my column, was we need him to now show the same level of focus, determination, if necessary, ruthlessness, and certainly muscularity, to stare down these forces that are arranged against
him. Absolutely. It's interesting how the same set of facts can lead to different feelings of satisfaction or dissatisfaction or even political analyses. I'm inclined to agree with Richard. I wonder whether you are as well. Richard starts off explaining the president and the constraints and how no one person has a magic wand, which is a point that you've often made in your analysis over the last 2 years. And I think that's cogent. He then critiques him by saying he needs to be more muscular. I also think he needs to be more muscular. Do you think he's doing enough, or do you think that his dominant strength, which was historically important leading up to 1994, it's still an important tool in the toolkit to leverage whenever you need to, not least when you have near intractable differences in the party or the state. But as a dominant orientation in leadership, that perhaps he needs to segue from that to the person that takes full executive authority seriously, even if he should end up being a one-term president.
I think the president shouldn't be more muscular. I think the president should be more feminist. So if he does that, then he cuts through the intersection of the various problems that faces the country.
Okay, unpack that?
Unpack. It's simple to unpack, Eusebius. The cost of gender-based violence in South Africa is estimated at about 42 billion rand. That is what it will cost the state, right? We've had a gender-based summit that still doesn't have a cent committed to it in actual terms. Neither the Justice Minister nor the President can tell us how much money is actually there. And if Tito Mboweni's economic plan is anything to go by, women don't even feature in it. And if the President says, like he correctly diagnosed what is eating away at South Africa, which was inequality. And he said the face of inequality is that of a female black woman. And if he deals with that female black woman and makes her, which is a metaphor for the majority, literally and figuratively, because we are the majority, if he makes that the priority in his governance, then he will actually be on a path that intersects in such a way that you will have law enforcement, policy, and implementation beginning to work together. And I think we need to strengthen a gendered lens for the president. I am deeply disappointed in Naledi Pandor, who 2 days ago or a day ago blamed the media for saying South Africa's not xenophobic. She said no foreign minister ran away from her in Zimbabwe, and yet her president stood there in front of 40,000 people in a stadium apologizing. He's going from town to town now explaining that we actually have severe economic problems and we can't pit other poor African migrants against ourselves, and that it is state and capital failure, private sector failure, that is at the root of why poor people are set on each other, or the vulnerable are set on each other. So,
but does he have clarity of purpose? I mean, let's say, for example, you were his advisor and you said to him, Mr. President, if we could look 50 years forward and let's imagine we get everything we want, me as your advisor secretly, and someone writes a political textbook of what had happened over the previous 50 years, we would want a chapter on you to say this was a feminist president. We can talk about what the detail means in the next Blue Sky Thinking workshop, but that is our, that is the brand around which we will coalesce. That's clarity of purpose.
Yes.
But does he have that, or is he really going, and I want you to think about this because I've got to go to news headlines, is he going from one crisis to the next? Is he going from one context to the next? Because I'm as disappointed with Minister Pandor. I expected more from her. But even on the xenophobia, Karima, I would disagree with you. The president in the last week alone has been changing his language to suit the particular context in which he has spoken. He's been less bad than her, but not as clear as he could have been.
No, live, transform. This is 702. This is 702. For the curious.
23 minutes before noon, we're talking politics, and in particular drilling down into the details of the president's leadership strengths and weaknesses, assessing his time in office and also his Monday job. And I'm in conversation with two of our best political commentators, Richard Calland, who is all the way in Germany but made time for us, and Karima Brown, who's here in studio with me in Johannesburg. I want you to be part of this conversation, right? So I'm sure you've been listening attentively to their incredible, incisive commentary, but do you agree, disagree with anything they say? Politics is not a perfect science, if it is a science at all. So call in, you can engage them, debate with them, or maybe you just have a question as someone who is an active citizen that follows the news, but you're not an expert on these issues. Give us a call, 011-883-0702. Karima, you wanted to engage a little bit my question. I agree with you that the president, as I said, was better than Minister Pandor. I think you give him way too much credit. I think the guy's been somewhat mild at best in trying to contain the xenophobic attitude. He's scared of the word. He apologizes, yeah. He sends envoys abroad. Then next thing to rapturous applause. He knows he's deliberately saying things like, yeah, but they must respect our laws. So answer that. And then I think you wanted to give a bit more meat to the bones around the issue of what it means to have a gender-focused project that could play into Richard's idea of a very clearly defined legacy.
Yes, I think that President Ramaphosa was slow out of the starting blocks when the country was engulfed by both femicide and xenophobia, which the media shone a light on. That is not to say that it hasn't been going on for a lot longer than this. And I think that the reason for that is because of the deep denial that his party is actually in about these two questions. Many people in the ANC were in foreign countries, and mentally they cannot actually get over the hurdle of the fact that South Africans were not the only people, black South Africans were not the only people who were cut off from the rest of the world when apartheid was isolated and said to be a crime against humanity. We too were cut off, except for people who went into exile. So we have very little knowledge of the rest of the continent. We have very little knowledge of the way in which the rest of the continent interacts with the world, which is in a migration crisis, as you know. It's not as if migration is a uniquely South African problem. Europe is caught in it. Australia is caught in it. The US is caught in it. Mm. And I think the psyche of the exiles in the ANC around this question dominates discussions. And I think what needs to happen is that new blood needs to inform this discussion. Naledi Pandor, Nosiviwe Mapisa Nqakula, must take a look in the mirror that is South Africa and see what it reflects back. You know what was so disappointing for me? When she went onto the television, and she's the Minister of Defense, she initially said that there was a crime intelligence problem. A few days after that, she was in a cluster, security cluster, which she leads.
Yeah.
And she basically contradicted herself directly by saying that they had gotten updates and briefs from day one from the intelligence structures. And the Minister of Security was sitting in the same panel as her. Mm. This is a woman who broke our laws to bring a woman from another country, remember, to South Africa to escape what she called gender-based violence, who didn't want to deal with that issue. The other thing that is problematic for me about the inability of the ANC to formulate language conceptually about what this is someone like Becky Cele, who says we're going to put more female police officers as the frontliners. So again, women must take responsibility for the actions of rapists when the survivors come in. He doesn't tell us what budget he has to train his entire police force, including the males, who are in fact one of the largest sectors that contributes to femicide, because they kill their intimate partners more so than any other group. He's not telling us what kind of diversity training they're going to get. He places that responsibility on a female police officer. And people think that is progress. Now, when that security cluster was sitting there, I was wondering whether these people are in the same cabinet, because it looked as if they were all working in silos, right? And I think that is what the president needs to do. And that is why a feminist perspective is something that he must be engaged on. We must contest him for that narrative, and we must fight for that narrative to be adopted, because it is only through that intersectionality from an approach that you will be able to get, first of all, resources, money. You will get action implementation, and you will get a commitment. If the president and people like Pravin Gordhan and others could go to civil society and say, help us fight state capture, why are they not coming to society and saying to us, help us fight the drivers of xenophobia and gender-based violence?
100%. Richard, let's focus more explicitly on the state of the state. If someone stopped you in the streets of Berlin where you are and said to you, Professor Callant, what the hell is going on in your country? I see images, an international copy of xenophobic violence, and I see headline economic data suggesting on an expansive definition that over 50% of your young people are unemployed and therefore don't have a stake in your democratic project. You are still infamously one of the most unequal societies on the planet in terms of both income, asset, and other forms of inequalities. My good God, does your government not have an interest in governing? What say you?
Yeah, a couple of nights ago, you say, because I got in a cab and the driver happened to be a Nigerian immigrant. He's been in Berlin 20 years, and he was watching his television whilst driving, which in itself was quite an interesting proposition. But his little TV was a program about the xenophobia in South Africa, a Nigerian channel that he was. And so he was very concerned about it. And, you know, obviously in the conversation, he asked the sorts of questions you just put to me, saying, what the hell is going on there? And you know, can you not get a grip? So there isn't obviously a simple answer to that, because these problems run very deep. And if there's one thing that this last 15-minute segment of your program shows, is that South Africa faces a multiple crisis. There is a deep social crisis around femicide. There is a deep economic crisis around jobs and inequality. And there is a recovering, I would call it, political leadership crisis. It's recovering, and I'm turning to your question finally, it's recovering because what Ramaphosa has done in the last 18 months is start the process of rebuilding the democratic state. And he did that, first of all, last year by firing and getting rid of key accomplices to the Zuma state capture project, appointing good, qualified, honest people into key positions, whether it be in SARS or in the National Prosecuting Authority, and so on. And that was an absolutely essential first step. And I think it's quite remarkable, actually, we shouldn't lose sight of this fact, despite the crisis that surrounds us, that in the last 18 months, there have been these multiple commissions of inquiry. That is remarkable, because I can't think of many, if any, places in the world where a sitting government would appoint commissions of inquiry which are effectively against itself. And that's what Ramaphosa has overseen. And the evidence that is emerging through the Zondo Commission and other commissions is really quite remarkable. The question then, of course, is what do you do with that? Do you bring accountability to bear? Do you then reform and rebuild? And I think he's done remarkably well on that. I think, you know, if one was giving him a mark, you'd give him I would give him a first class honours in terms of that. Has it translated into economic revival yet? No, it hasn't. And that's then the key question. And whether his legacy is to be one of being a feminist president or something else, regardless of what the headline is, he has to revive this economy. So in 3 years' time, if this economy is not revived, if jobs are not being created, if state-owned enterprises have not been turned around and big problems solved in that sector, then, you know, his legacy will not, unfortunately, be a good one. He will be treated as a failure.
And I'm going to come back to that in our last 10 minutes of conversation, because that takes us into what we could have spent an hour on, but we need to at least hit that headline, a technocratic question about the state. Before we do so, let's hear from one of our listeners, Karima. Richard, good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I nearly jumped in early when you said Richard, but of course it was the other Richard, Richard the First. This is Richard the Second.
Richard the Second. What do you want to say?
Okay. So all of this happens in a context, which is the business community as well. And the whole of the economy, from the tiniest little person in a small town to the Patrick Motsepe's and others. Patrice Motsepe. I am disappointed in the business community at not having engaged in a more robust and positive and proactive way instead of waiting to see if Cyril succeeds. That should not be the case. They should be there to enable him to. I mean, in a sense, he's one of them. He has a parentage that comes out of union action in the mining industry, but was very close to the industry of the mining industry and his own. Since he became a businessman. South African business needs to get involved with the president, with the leading opposition party who have expressed an interest in working with those parts of the ANC that would be open to a brighter future, as it were, and a less political future. Where are these business people?
Richard the Second? You are speaking stuff that makes communist Karima Brown very excited. Karima, you and I love going to business and saying what Richard is saying and fleshing that out. I kept them out just for analytic purposes, but as Richard the First has said, these distinctions are neat discursively, but our reality is interconnected. We often talk about that much-punted social compact, and in fact, President Ramaphosa was meant to bring business to the party and get his mates to be a little bit more committed to things like servant leadership, conscious capitalism. But he can't solve all of those problems. There is a dearth of ethical leadership from within corporate South Africa. This conversation is about the ANC and Cyril. But just speak for 1 minute into Richard II's point.
Well, I'm glad Richard III is not present. Last Friday, Eusebius, I decided that I wasn't going to work. I was going to take to the streets, particularly to the JSE, which is the kind of edifice of corporate South Africa in geographic terms here in Sandton. And we had the outgoing president coming out, flying apparently from some place in the world to come and listen to our demands. And what the women outside and some of the male allies who were there asked for was a levy towards funding the decisions taken from the gender-based violence summit. Because as we know, South Africa has a deficit of, 57 billion rand. We don't know how well Edward Kiesvetter is doing in trying to turn things around, because he too wrote his staff an extraordinary letter where he admitted his shame of being part of toxic masculinity, both as an employer, as an institution, but committing, to this issue. And I think what I would want from the president is to urge business leadership South Africa, who up to a few months ago was actually led by Tanya Cohen, a female To come to the party on this matter. If you take it down to the municipalities, which is what business always tells us where government failure lies, right? They say that a business needs water, it needs electricity, it needs a reliable transport system for it to function. But what it also needs is perhaps a sponsored CCTV that can be put up at a train station, at a taxi stop, so that the women who get up at 4 o'clock that serves you your coffee at your first business meeting at 7 o'clock cannot be attacked and can come to work safely. And business can donate that because they have donated CCTVs to all the districts where they have businesses in the big cities. We need the same for rural areas. I was at a vigil at Wits. Wits just needs better lighting. There needs to be more light on that campus. When the vigil was finished, I had to walk back to my car in almost complete darkness. So the private sector and the vice chancellors can dig into some of their funds and just have better lighting, for example. The Tutuzela
centers. And some of that expenditure is not the 2% being demanded, that will be 0.01%, but it changes the gendered relations and arrangements in the world of work.
Precisely, but also it deals with other things. We have overcrowded prisons. So even if we convict more, as the police minister promises, it sends those people to a place that breeds toxic masculinity. We've already got, compared to other countries, more prisoners who serve as lifers or who serve life sentences with no parole. There's no places for these people to go. In Brazil, they have a program where a prisoner gets points for every book that he reads and explains. I have yet to see the rehabilitative budget of correctional services.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And the level of crime in Brazil has actually come down. And Brazil is in many ways is a country similar to ours in terms of toxic masculinity and also levels of inequality. So we need to think out of the box. We also need to look at the trauma that has gone from one generation to the next. The cost of uprooting black families through colonialism is the sin of apartheid colonialism.
I want to take a break here, Karima, but just to underscore what you're saying, if I may impose an additional conclusion on your brilliant individual points. It is important, and I said this at the conference yesterday morning, to be state-centric because of the state's monopoly on collecting taxes, passing legislation, and on force. But the kinds of things that you've outlined tells us that non-state actors, both corporate citizens and us as individual citizens, need to take our agency seriously, even while we are critiquing the president.
Absolutely.
Eusebius Makaiza on 702 for the curious.
I wanted to ask you, Richard, about the state of our technocracy, because if it's not in good shape, then we can kiss goodbye the economic challenges that we need to overcome that you spoke to in the last sentence or two before I'd gone to Karima. But you can either jump in there or also engage Richard II on the importance of non-state actors also being in this conversation and not just the ANC, the government and the president. You've got 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you. That's more than enough time to cover those big topics. I think you know this program needs to be at least 4 hours, not 45 minutes. But anyway, just you know, Richard II makes a very good point. The private sector needs to do more. Some parts of the private sector have stepped up in the last couple of years. They stepped up firstly as part of the fight back against the Zuma catch of the state. But they haven't sustained it. Some have continued to work with Ramaphosa to reach consensus. Quite a lot of stuff is going under the radar because it's not big and flashy. There aren't sort of big releases. There aren't pictures of Ramaphosa being handed a check. It's kind of the stuff he's good at, which is building consensus around the technocratic changes in economic policy and growth creation. So there is good stuff going on, but the private sector does need to do more. Is to match what the civil society and the press sectors have done in the last few years, which I think has been extraordinary. The reason South Africa is a vibrant democracy, despite everything, the fact that we're having this conversation, despite the threats to media freedom that come from different quarters, including the ultra-populism and nationalism nationalism and violent nationalism of the EFF and other forces in our society. Despite all of that, there is a vibrant democracy at work.
Karima, as you would say on The Fix, colleagues, we're going to run out of time. 45 seconds.
I want the president to start fixing the lives of black working class women. The knock-on effects of that for the rest of the health of the society will be incredible. Start by valuing the work that women do in the home and make it part of how you calculate GDP. Start by making sure that women are part of the groups of people that are covered in the for minimum wage. Start by making sure that women are part of the discussion around land restitution and title deeds and ownership. Talk about women when you talk about safety. Talk to women when you talk about education and reorientating a toxic masculinity. And most of all, advance an education that allows males to be able to be the kind of people that will be allies toward women. That, for me, is the challenge. And if he addresses that, the knock-on effects and the intersectionality of the problems that beset us will become a lot easier.
Richard, thanks for your German-based generosity. And Karima, to you too, coming to studio.
Thank you.